is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Brad Watson. He's the author of a novel called Miss Jane. And I have to say that just in terms of pure writing, this is one of the most amazing books I've read in a really long time. And I read a lot of books. I read a lot of good books. But Brad, I have to tell you, the writing in this book is just beyond. It's almost more than I can say how much I really liked it.
No, thanks, David. Is there any way you can translate that into a bestseller?
If I could, I would be happy to do that. I think there's generally almost a direct, you know, it's almost the reverse. If something is really, really good, it's probably less likely to be a bestseller.
So that's one of my favorite booksellers. A friend of mine told me, I said I had hopes for this book selling better than some previous books. And he said, well, there are a few things you need to do. And one thing he said was you need to take down the notch down the quality of your prose a little bit. You know, we were laughing, but I don't know.
Yeah, right. I think
maybe he meant it.
I think he probably did. Now, you know, I always try not to give away too much of a book when we're talking about a book with an author, because it's not fair to so many readers, you know, if we give away stuff. But, you know, I think there's been some writing about this book that I've read, so I think there is some discussion of it out there, that this is about a character. It's a novel about a woman that you kind of built out of a family member of yours, a great aunt. And what's really striking about this book is that you did so much imaginative work to be able to inhabit this person in a time and place that is, you know, so different from our own. And this is in Mississippi, in the town that you've made up called Mercury, around the early part of the 20th century. And maybe you could talk a little bit about just how you managed to get to this place.
I had a harder time getting to it than I have with stories in the past, in my previous novel also. Mercury is sort of based on my hometown, Meridian, Mississippi. And I have, and always will, I think, have vivid memories of growing up in Meridian and the landscape and the feel of it and the smell and things there. So when I wrote The Heaven of Mercury, set in Mercury, I didn't have that hard a time, especially since I made it Mercury, not Meridian, and gave myself liberties. I didn't have a very hard time imagining that place and sort of getting my head into it and getting it on the page. But this novel is set on a farm north in the country, north of Mercury. And although my mom grew up on a farm and told me a few stories, and we would visit my uncle's and aunt's farms, her brothers and sisters up there, on weekends, you know, I didn't grow up on a farm, so it didn't sink as deeply into me as this town life did. And usually they wouldn't let me, you know, help them do farm chores or anything like that. By the time I got old enough to do that, we didn't go up there so regularly anymore. So my experience with farm life was through my mom's stories and just what I could pick up as a sort of observant kid going up there. And as far as the character herself, yeah, I got the idea for her from my great aunt. It was my mom's aunt. Her name was Mary Alice Clay. She was nicknamed Jane. For some reason, no one could tell me anymore why. And all we knew about Jane was that she was born with a birth defect that left her incontinent and unable to marry and have children in a time when women were expected to do that. I saw her once when I was a little kid, and I never forgot seeing her. She seemed like a very old woman, rather than very frail. Not as old as I thought she was, probably. And then I was going through some photos with my mom some 20 years later and saw a picture of a young, nice-looking woman looking at a camera. back at the camera. Someone's taking a snapshot of her. And I thought she looked flirtatious. And I asked who she was, and my mom said it was Aunt Jane. And I said, well, how? It looks like she's flirting with the camera. And that's when my mom told me that my great aunt had had a period when she was very popular with the boys, and she used to go to community dances up there in the country. I asked how she might have done that, given the fact that she basically had to wear a diaper her entire life and didn't have a romantic life later on. How did she pull this off? My mom had no idea. But we did know that she, to some point, she must have pulled back from that attempt to be a social person, because she did live her life alone, perhaps on welfare, we don't know. And the only people she really associated with were members of her family. But she was always regarded as a very cheerful person. She was very beloved by those who knew her. There are a few people alive who still remembered her vaguely. No one had real great memories about her. No one knew exactly what her condition had been. So when I started to write about her, I was intrigued by this potential attempt at a love affair that maybe my great aunt had, and the idea that she would have had to pull back from it, and how a person would have dealt with that and stayed strong and maintained her integrity and become an admirable person in the family. So I started trying to write about her. It was really the hard thing for me was at first, of course, deciding what must have been her condition.
You figured that out. And wait, did you do medical research in order to, I mean, I think you must have done some work in not only in the medical condition that she had, but also in the history of medicine, because when you wrote about this during that period of time, the condition that you uncovered that she most likely had, which is persistent cloaca, was not anything that anyone then could actually address surgically.
Yeah, when I happened on that, it made sense to me for a few reasons. One is that it's possible to have that. It is a birth defect, I mean, you're born that way. And it was that particular condition happens only in women. And it is possible, given certain, the circumstances in the condition, it's possible that a person with this condition might go through life without having the kind of persistent, constant problem with infections that so many other more common conditions leave people struggling with. And apparently my aunt was not at the doctor all the time. She was a robust person, although she was very, very thin, which was also sort of an interesting clue to me plot-wise. When I was thinking about how my great aunt and how my character in the book might devise a way to go to dances and be popular with boys without, disgusting them because she smelled bad or had some sort of an accident, I thought, well, what would I do? I would starve myself. I would dehydrate myself so that I could go and I could have some normal fun for a while without worrying about anything. And when I started writing about that, I realized that that could be a kind of an alluring sort of condition. You get dehydrated enough and you haven't eaten in quite a while and you're kind of out of it. You sort of, gracefully stoned.
yeah, that's true.
This could be potentially really attractive, sort of mysterious attractiveness in someone, especially a beautiful teenage girl with these teenage boys seeing her at the dance, someone who's been a kind of recluse, mystery anyway. And then when she goes to these dances, shows up in a nice dress and shoes, and she's beautiful and she's a little bit weird. And I thought, yeah, this works. So, I used what clues I could to to what few clues I had to try to put together what may have been wrong with my aunt and what would work with my character. But yes, you're right. I did. I read as much as I could in text. I read about intersexuality. You know, they used to call hermaphrodism. I read. My mother said that the family was certain my aunt wasn't an intersexual person. I read this character is mentioned in the book, but he doesn't appear as a real character. Dr. Hugh Young was a famous surgeon, an innovator in urodental surgery techniques at Johns Hopkins in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And I read his book. I had to get a copy of it from the Harvard library because it's such a rare book. I had to get a photocopy, but I did get that, and I read through that book. I didn't find anything that seemed to work for me. I read this guy's biography, Hugh Young's biography, and finally I went to the internet. And fairly late in trying to figure out how to write this book, I found this condition, and I said, that works. And then I couldn't really find a doctor who would talk to me about this particular condition.
And why is that?
Because doctors are very busy people.
Oh, okay. Not that they're not afraid to talk about it, just too busy to talk to you.
Well, yeah, if I found out that probably my best bet would have been a pediatric surgeon, but, you know, these people are not the most common doctors, you know, in a community. And they're just very, very busy people. I finally, you know, I did the research mostly on my own with a little help from a hint here and there. And then finally, one of my students, father, who is an OBGYN, I found out that he, in semi-retirement, really loved to assist his friends, various specialties in surgery. And I thought he might know something. So I ran what I had, my best, you know, assessment of the situation by him. And he said that, yes, this, what I wanted to find out was, you know, am I describing this condition correctly? Is it possible for things to be this particular way if someone has this condition? You know, what are some things they would have to live with? How would they have to how would they deal with it? And this is how I had written it in the book. And luckily, I got most of that right because it was pretty late in drafting the book. So I did get some good help from him. But mostly it was a lot of frustrating, you know, hide and seek work. I realized I couldn't write the book till I figured out, to my satisfaction, what her condition might have been. The book kept getting delayed, and I kept peeling off and working on something else for a while out of frustration. I did that for almost 10 years before I was able to sit down and put a good solid 2.5 years or so into drafting the book out. But it was, even then, it was hard. It was hard to imagine her life, like you said. Now, how do you imagine if you're a man who was born, you know, over half a century after this person, who lived a different kind of life than she did in terms of place and daily activities and so on. Plus, you have someone whose life is limited socially so much by her condition, and she's living on the side of the farm. How do you imagine her life and give it any kind of dramatic arc whatsoever? So I did a lot of drafts, just trying different things out, trying to write my way into what I thought might have been an interesting way of getting inside her head and understanding what her daily life might have been.
And of course, you have to understand not only her, but all the people that she grows up with, and the doctor. I love the character of the doctor who delivers her, the country doctor, and who, you know, pretty much stays with her all his life as she becomes grown, and he kind of takes care of her in a way that's really special. I just thought that was, you know, that was really powerful in that he's also a really unusual character that you were able to, you know, wrap your imagination around.
Yeah, I had a lot of, I enjoyed writing the doctor very much. And he was in there early on to the point where I was so fond of writing about him, and he was, you know, it was easy for me to gain access to him. So I thought for a while, one of my problems might be that the doctor is taking over this book.
Yeah.
but I started, then I became more interested in writing some chapters through the point of view of Jane's father and her mother and her sister. And gradually, the book began to take on a balance in terms of perspectives. And also, I realized that when I wrote about Jane through the eyes of someone else, her mother, father, sister, or the doctor, that it sort of eased the pressure up on me in terms of having to figure out completely on my own, who she was, what she was, how to get into her head. I know this sounds kind of phony, but it really did help for me to write through other points of view. It helped me to see her in a way that I was having a hard time seeing her just on my own. It sounds very writerly.
That makes complete sense. That's the way of getting at it. You know, you were kind of looking at different prisms in a way. You know, the one thing I wanted to ask you about this, and I don't think this is giving away too much, but it felt like she's a character who has this, the worst challenge imaginable, and makes a way of living despite it. And at the same time, all of the people in the story, her mother, her father, her sister, the doctor, they all are, quote, normal. You know, they don't have this physical challenge. And yet none of them, in a way, none of them finds peace in the same way that she does. So you have that kind of, that's the irony of the story for me. And I wondered if that was something you thought about as you were writing, or if that just evolved, as part of the storytelling.
Well, yeah, I did think about it, and I thought the doctor came closest to arriving at his own, you know, separate piece. The closest to Jane's success with that as anyone, and insofar as he's able to be a model for her, a model of accepting your who you are and what your circumstances are. I meant for him to play a role in that fashion in the book also. Mm. Even though he really never does get over his melancholy.
Both in his own personal relationships, in his own sensibilities about who he is, and also with his feelings about Jane. You know, I agree with you. He's more thoughtful and has a better sensibility than perhaps the others who are struggling, but he still never fully reconciles.
No, but I think one thing that helps him is, you know, how deeply he cares for Jane. Not only her doctor delivers her, becomes her interested in her case, and then he sort of becomes an avuncular sort of friend. And in the end, it's almost as if they're platonic lovers. I mean, they're so close, and they're both such loners.
Yeah, I did. I actually felt, I wondered during the course of the book whether you were going there. I actually felt that possibility was lurking all the time, that she would end up in some sort of a relationship with him beyond the one that she had, which was more like an uncle or a surrogate parent. I didn't feel like you were messing around with us in any way, but I just sort of, you know, you always felt it there as, and I think that's legitimate. There are, you know, our relationships with other people sometimes are complicated by ambiguity that, that possibility for the more than relationship is there with so many people in our lives. We don't choose to pursue, but that tension exists.
I think she's, I think he's the person that she's most able to communicate with openly and honestly, you know, and he knows everything about her. He doesn't judge anything about her. There's nothing about her that is a threat to him, as it is, say, with the mother and the father and even the sister to some degree. I think they feel threatened by her presence and her condition in some weird way. But the doctor's not, and he, I think more than anybody else, sees her, except for, you know, a few times the father, sees her as a human being who is, of course, hampered by this physical condition, but I think in his estimation, she's able to access her humanity in a way that other people who are physically intact around her are quite unable to do. And he admires that. And what she admires in him is his gentle acceptance, his kindness, and I think she likes his eccentricity.
Yeah, yeah. And I think you also have her being more, when you said she accesses her humanity, she also accesses her connection with the natural world in a way that seems to be particular as well. That being able to, you know, the empathetic relationship she has with the world around her is really powerful.
Yeah, in trying to figure out what she might have done with her days, and how she might have come to some sort of not only understanding of herself and who she was, but an acceptance of it. In the course of writing the book, it became important that her time in the world, in the natural world, as you say, in the woods, you know, became really important, because it's there where she realizes that there are all kinds of strange things in nature. There are all kinds of oddities. There are all kinds of weird looking plants, and animals are strange. It's being in the woods, when she's in the woods, you know, she realizes it helps her to realize that she's just another manifestation of a human being, the same way that, you know, the mushrooms may be just simply other strange manifestations of regular plants. So, it's there where I think she comes to some sort of center, where she figures out how to accept who she is and how to not feel like a freak, how to feel like she has just as much business living in the world as anybody else, even though society has a harder time, you know, coming to those terms.
Yeah. So when you, I mean, this is sort of a writing process question, I guess. You know, how do you come to, I mean, well, or maybe I should just say, what will you, having done a book like this, which I think is very difficult, do you feel like you want to do something different? Or is this completely in line with the arc of your feelings about what you want to be writing about?
You know, I've been thinking a lot about that lately. I really don't know what I'm going to do next. This one took more out of me than anything I've done before and left me pretty worn out. And in the last 2 or 3 months, I've been thinking that, you know, I think I might have sort of reached the end of some kind of cycle with this book in terms of what I want to write about, and maybe even to some degree how I want to do it. So I'm not sure what I'm going to go after next. I think I want to change.
Do you write stories when you're not thinking about a novel, or do you just, I mean, do you have a plan, or is it kind of whatever comes to your mind at a particular time?
Yeah, especially, you know, if I'm stuck on something, I peel off and I'll work, and I have several novels I've started. I mean, everything from, you know, another novel about Mercury, the town. I considered doing a couple more novels and maybe having a trilogy, and I've set pretty decent ideas about that. I think I would write it a little bit differently. Miss Jane is, I think, is much tighter and has a more spare style, and I think is actually probably better written overall than The Heaven of Mercury. And so if I wrote other Mercury novels, I would I pursued those ideas I've started and put down and made notes on and written some scenes on. I would I'd go after them, but I'd not, you know, realizing that I'm a different writer than the one I was in 2002. But also, yeah, I'll write stories when I'm stuck on something or just feel like writing a short story again. Lately, I've been writing some essays. But yeah, I want to do another novel and perhaps a collection of linked stories. I published a couple of stories in Granada and in New Yorker where, with the same characters, these three boys. And I'm thinking about doing a collection of something like 6 to 8 stories with those people. I mean, I've even begun a noir, I've begun a road thriller. I've begun a coming of age novel, it's sort of also about my hometown in a different way. I got lots of things that I could go back to, but I was just telling, my agent the other day, I said, I really don't know if I want to go back to those or if I want to sort of sit here and try to be quiet and see if there's another different kind of thing bubbling up. I wrote most of a novel about the desegregation of the public schools in Mississippi, which happened in 1969 and 70. I think I did that in 2012 and sort of derailed. But, it's a worthwhile project, so I might go back to that, give it a try. I just don't know right now. I'm not sure what I want to write. I really sort of emptied the well, in my, because I must have done 25, 30 drafts of that, of Jane over the years.
Yeah, no, I read somewhere that you said you'd written something like 30 drafts, and I can completely, it's just, I'm so impressed with your ability to do that and finish, and just stay with it for so long. So I think you should give yourself room to recover, you need some space.
Yeah.
And,
I have to, yeah. It was exhausting.
You teach writing at the University of Wyoming. Do you find, I wanted to ask you about this, that does that take pressure off your writing, or, how does it work? Does that give you like a breather because you're working on other people's stuff with them, or does it prevent you in some way at some times from getting to your own work because you don't have that peacefulness that you alluded to a minute ago?
Well, it's double-edged. I mean, there's a lot of joy in working with young writers. Especially the most talented ones. And I mean, the most talented among the undergrads, and I mean, pretty much all of the graduate students, they're all good when they come here and they're doing exciting work. And that can really be enlivening. And it's exciting to see them figuring it out and getting it out there and then sometimes getting book deals and their life changes. And then so often I advise them not to teach. the other edge of that is, the old adage, be careful about turning what you love into your job. Because you are putting the same kind of effort and energy. It's the same work, that you're doing with them that you are doing on your own work. So it feels as if you're working, you doubled. Your job is kind of doubled up. You really want to work and get all those ideas you have of your own down on the page and get them out before you're gone. But there's only so much you can do. And when you're giving a good bit of that same energy and thinking, critical thinking, creative thinking, you know, to people you care about, it's just less, you know, to go around when you sit down at your own desk. I found that was a, you know, it's not as tiring when you're working a regular 9-to-5 job. I've worked labor, I've worked journalism, I've worked, well, journalism, I tell you what, that was hard to come home and work after that. But I've written advertising, I've written public relations. And most of those jobs leave me more time and mental freedom to work on my own work than teaching does, because I'm, you know, you're taking work home, you're thinking about your students' stories, you want them to succeed, you have them out. So it's kind of like working twice as long as you would normally work on your own work, unless you're someone, you know, crazy like George Simenon, who worked all the time.
Yeah.
There's only so long you can do that, I think.
Right. That's unless you're really, really, yeah, there are a few people who can pretty much turn it on and never turn it off, but it seems like...
I don't know how many years you can do it. At some point, though, you know, at some point you sit up and you say, I don't know if I can work 12, 16-hour days, 7 days a week anymore, and that's kind of what's going on.
Yeah. I watched this film just the other day about Dalton Trumbo, who was... an amazing writer, and he actually, there was a period of time when he was blacklisted, but he wrote pseudonymously at an incredible pace because he was getting underpaid. And as you see him in the film, and you know, as his biography points out, you know, he was writing just hours and hours and hours every day, every night, every week. And I think it took its toll. I think it really, really took its toll on him.
Sure. Yeah, some people can do it naturally, it seems. But then, you know, I think a lot of people like that, they're doing it, they're keeping the engine going by fueling it with amphetamines, alcohol, all these kinds of things that, you know, that eventually turn on you.
That's right.
And take, you know, take you down. So it's like, well, I'm going to go ahead and burn it out, you know, see how much I can get done. And I don't want to burn it out. I want to somehow figure a way to make it last. I think I might be directing this program in the future, if possible. So it'll be more. I might be more of an administrator than back away from the classroom a little bit, and we'll see if that, you know, taking a break from the classroom is good for me or not. I'll find out. I remember I once got to meet Shelby Foote 20 years ago, and that's when I was about to go off to teach at Harvard, which was the best job, teaching job I'd ever had. And I was excited about it. And he said, why the hell would you want to do something like that? I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, if I was going to work a job, I'd pump gas or, you know, something like that, where I wouldn't, you know, I'd keep my mind free to work on my fiction.
Right. You work the 9-to-5 simple job that doesn't take too much of your creative energy away from you. Yeah. I've.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I was already married and had children, you know, so I had already bought into, you know, I needed insurance. I needed a decent salary and all these things. So, I think Shelby's probably right. The ideal job for a writer is a mindless job that's going to leave you free to do a little daydreaming and get you charged up to go to work when you get home. But those don't usually pay a living wage.
That is true. No, so, that is, I'm sure that's true.
Yeah.
Well, I really enjoyed talking to you, Brad. And you know, it's like, I have to go back and say again that this book it was just transcendent. It was a beautiful piece of work, or is a beautiful piece of work. I loved reading it. I'm going to go read your other work, because this is the first book of yours I've read. And I hope to read the next book that you write.
Well, thanks, David. I hope the same thing happens with other readers. You know, I hope they read this one, it makes them want to read the other. So I'd love to see them stay alive. Right now, they're all in print.
Oh, that's so good.
That's a good sign.
You're lucky.
Yeah, that's right. True. It was good talking to you.
You as well. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Brad Watson about his exceptionally good novel, Miss Jane.